Welcome to the St Emmeline's podcast. I'm Ian Beardsall.
And I'm Simon Carley.
And this is our recording for both March and April. Obviously, we usually like to get you out a monthly podcast, but we've been a bit busy this month. Simon, as the CPD lead, you've been organising the RChem conference. And me as an RChem speaker, I've been worrying about speaking at the RChem conference. And then we had a bit of Easter in the middle. But here we are, ready to catch up. How are things with you?
Pretty good. It's quite busy. I think it is everywhere. And I think a lot of people are under quite a lot of stress at the moment. But there's also some good stuff going on as well. Some research projects on the go. Quite a lot of teaching and education. It's really nice, actually, that I would say in the last month, I've got back to meeting people face-to-face on a regular basis for meetings, but particularly for things like education and research meetings. That's really made, it's actually made my mood go up a little bit. I think all the Zoom stuff, yeah, you can do it, but it doesn't really float my boat, to be honest.
It's definitely nice to be in the room. And I felt that energy when we were at Bournemouth for the conference. And it was just nice to see people again.
It was a really, really, really good time to get together. And as I say, to link up with people who I've known for years and years and years, but haven't actually seen for about three.
Now, Simon, you mentioned the busyness in emergency departments, and I think the NHS generally at the moment. It's getting quite hard. There's been a lot of Twitter activity about people really struggling. And perhaps our first thing we should talk about as we discuss the blog posts for March and April is the First Journal Club, which ties into this nicely about the association between delays to patient admission from the ED and all-cause 30-day mortality. This got a lot of interest and perhaps is the outcome for what we're all feeling.
It is. And I think we've known for many years that crowding in particular is associated with harm. But we struggle sometimes to communicate that to people because you can go into a department and say, look, it's really busy. People are going to come to harm here. But what I've had kickback from in the past is, well, tell me which one of these patients is the one that's going to come to harm. And of course, it's not as simple as that. You know, you might get the one patient who has been left in the waiting room for far too long, who then suddenly has a cardiac arrest and everybody goes, oh, that's a disaster. It's due to waiting. But the harm from crowding is more, it's more general. It just makes everything worse. You know, people don't get the drugs on time. They don't get good care on a corridor. I know our nurses are incredibly hardworking and try and do the best, but quite frankly, you don't have good care on a corridor. And we're seeing it a lot more these days. This study was a way of them trying to quantify just how harmful it is to keep people in emergency departments, in crowded emergency departments for long periods of time. And this must be something you've seen as well, Ian.
We do see this. It is just simply harder to look after people, isn't it? There is undoubtedly harm to the staff as well. And I think that's what we're seeing on Twitter and in other places. And when we're at work talking to people, there is that moral distress, as Liz Crowe would call it, of just not being able to do your best in the environment. And I see it really affecting people. I'm hearing stories at work of junior doctors who are really struggling, nursing staff. And I'm not sure that old fogies like me and you have the answer. It's all too easy to say, oh, in my day, or we're in a very privileged position. We've got to the end of our training as, you know, formal training anyway, and we've managed to get some portfolio careers. So we're not in the emergency department all the time. I think we do need to try and understand how our colleagues are feeling.
I agree. We did a Schwartz round recently, and it was very apparent that about just what the personal impact is of crowding on the staff. And I would agree with you that it's quite clear that this concept of moral injury, which we talked about with Esther, and it's quite clear that this is now really quite common amongst our colleagues. And we need to do everything that we can. One way perhaps is to get the data out there that really demonstrates it. And that's what this paper was really about. What they've essentially done is they've taken big data. So there's a lot of data which is collected about patients who come into hospital. So there's the hospital episode statistics, and the Office of National Statistics has lots and lots of data that they can put together and find out information. And so what they did is they looked at patients coming to the ED between sort of April 2016 and March 2018. And we're talking about huge numbers of patients here, millions of different episodes of data. And they've dug into that data and said, well, what can we find with this? Now, the data's okay. I mean, it's recorded. It's pretty good. We would say it's not been prospectively recorded specifically this study, but, you know, it's okay. We'll have some errors in it. But once you put millions of people in, then hopefully some of that biases will be pulled out. And they don't have all the data. So they don't have data on what actually was wrong with people or why it was that patient A stayed for 12 hours and patient B stayed for 2 hours. So there are some missing data in there. But what they can do is they can look at associations. They can look at the association between how long a patient is in the ED compared to what the likelihood is that they will survive. What did they find? The headline figures, you know, 26 million attendances were looked at, of which 7.5 million of them were actually admitted. And the primary outcome was death from all causes within 30 days of hospital admission. It's a pretty hard endpoint, that. I mean, but I think alongside that, we've also got to recognize that there may be associated morbidities with crowding, which wouldn't necessarily be apparent on here. What was the headline? Headline was, there is a linear increase in mortality with increasing delay to admission from the ED over 5 hours, with a visible inflection point at the 4 hour mark. If you stay beyond 4 hours, you're more likely to die. And that is really quite remarkable. And the big figure that got me was, if you stay 6 to 8 hours, as opposed to within 4 hours, your number needed to harm, i.e. the number needed to kill in this occasion, is 82. So for every 82 patients who stay longer than they should do in the 6 to 8 hour mark, an additional one would die. Once you get over 8 hours, it's 1 in 72. Now, I don't know about your department, Ian, but I would say that every day we have more than that number of patients waiting for more of that amount of time.
So just to confirm, what you were saying there is that if you wait over 6 hours, an extra patient who otherwise wouldn't have died out of 70 or 80, one out of every 70 or 80 patients who shouldn't have died will die. Am I reading that right?
It's an association, not a causation. So it's not quite as simple as it's purely about the time. There's an association there, and we need to unpick that. We're clearly not going to do a randomized controlled trial of keeping some people longer than others. So what's relatively convincing is the fact that there's a relatively strong linear relationship as well. So 5 to 6 hours is not as bad as 6 to 8 hours, which is not as bad as 8 to 12 hours. So there is a sort of a dosage effect of extra time being a worse effect on your likelihood of survival. And of course, from our perspective, that's also counterintuitive, because you'd hope that for the vast majority of patients, the sicker you are, the more likely you would be to move through the system more rapidly. And it's actually the patients who are relatively well who can be put on a corridor for 8 to 12 hours. Not advocating it, don't think it's a good idea, but that's what's happening.
The other thing that strikes me is just looking at the actual baseline crude mortality rate, we are exposed to a lot of death, aren't we? So 8.7% of all these patients ended up dying, admittedly within 30 days. They're not all dying within the emergency department, but we do have a funny job. This is not a normal job, is it, where you are, I mean, okay, undertakers and priests, but apart from those, we see a lot of people who will die in the weeks after we have been involved with them.
It's very true. And it's a good reminder that we've got to try and make the episodes when people do come to our department as good as they possibly can be, because those people may be towards the end of their life. And it's also worth remembering that in the first wave of COVID, the mortality for the COVID patients coming through was 30%, which again, I think a lot of us felt. You know, 1 in 3 of those patients that we saw, roughly 1 in 3 of the patients that we saw and were admitted with COVID, didn't make it out of hospital alive, which it is remarkable. And the last few years have really brought that into perspective, I think.
It's not really a normal job we do, is it, Simon?
No, in many ways not. There is one other thing on that study, which I think Govind and Charlie, who actually did the blog post on this paper, spotted something which I think had been missed by pretty much everybody else. And that is this point about the inflection being at 4 hours. So mortality suddenly starts to rise at that point. And the question that they've asked, which you can't answer from this very well, is that just because it's a 4 hour standard? So if we had a 5 hour standard, would the inflection take place at 5 hours? If it was 6 hours, would it take place at 6 hours? If it was 3 hours, would it take place at 3 hours? I think it's a really interesting philosophical question, because it does speak to whether or not this is actually just an effect of being in a space and not having good care, or whether it's the mechanisms and the systems that go around target-based behavior, something we've talked about a lot over the years on the podcast.
We have always been this binary under 4 hours, over 4 hours type target. And we have tried to move to mean time in the department and those sorts of things. But this paper does really tell the story of what we're all feeling at the moment, doesn't it? And as I say, Simon and I are kind of old fogies, and it is important to hear the voices of those of you who are really, really feeling it. Please do go and talk to people if you're struggling with this. And especially if you're thinking that emergency medicine isn't for you for whatever reason, then do find people. And Simon and I are relatively good positive examples of people who've been through it, got through it, and still managing to enjoy their life even after 15 or 20 years of doing it. Well, Simon, look, that's the shop floor at the moment. And let's just move away from that for a second to something perhaps more optimistic. And that was the conference. Delighted as always to be invited to speak. Really enjoy it until about 4 days before, when I start to become nervous, anxious, and lose control of many of my otherwise intact bodily functions. But thanks to Chris Gray, we've got some really good summaries from what happened at the conference, which I would encourage you to read, even if you went, because there'll be bits you didn't pick up on. Simon, you were there most, in fact, all of the week, I think. What were your highlights?
There's lots, and they're on the blog post. I won't run through a sort of an itinerary, but the person that I liked listening to the most was actually Chris Moulton, who was one of the authors on the paper we've just discussed, actually. Because what Chris did is he used an evidence-based approach, a data-led approach, to talk about where we are now. And actually, his talk was full of a great deal of hope. He talked about examples of where we can get it right. There are places where flow does happen, where the experience of emergency physicians is good, where patients get good care. But actually, we need to do much better as a system about sharing how those things work. And also, he's an incredibly funny and engaging speaker. So that, to me, was one of the highlights. There's some really good stuff in there about some of the more minor stuff that we see. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And of course, your talk on trauma team leadership, which was right at the beginning of the conference. But yeah, really good stuff. And if anybody wants to look at those presentations, you can still get access to them via the RKM websites for a small fee.
I did enjoy doing my talk. And there's a blog post as well that I put together about my talk, just in case you're one of the few people who wasn't able to attend the conference, just about some thoughts about trauma team leadership and how I've approached it over the years. And the way I just give myself a bit of a structure, it's all in there. So we won't go over it at great length now, but the idea that you prepare yourself, not dissimilar. And I compared it throughout to being a bit like a television program where you have act one, act two, and act three. And that's what you've got to prepare for. Act one is the preparation for the person coming. Act two is the actual looking after the patient. Act three is the bit where you're moving the patient through the department. And I even down to the fact that I kind of have a script in my head so that I just have that prepared and I just use it rote every time I'm doing a trauma and it offloads my brain.
Picked up some of that. I've used it subsequently that particularly the way that you introduce yourself and do the team in a very flat hierarchical way. To actually get the most out of everybody else in the room, I thought was very good. And we can apply that, of course, we can apply that to lots of other situations as well, not just trauma.
Oh, of course. Anytime you're looking after a critically unwell patient, or I'd even say that having a sort of script at handover is helpful. Just any structure that helps you repeat what you do in a way that means you don't have to worry too much and nothing is missed. That's the other thing here, is that everybody's ready.
Big mention for the zero-point survey, which again, loads of blog posts on that and something that everybody should be doing. Why doesn't everybody do the zero-point survey?
So the zero-point survey, just to remind people, is that just idea that you're doing something before the primary survey occurs, where you're preparing. And it does feel a bit fake sometimes. It feels like you're putting on a show, perhaps. But as soon as you're comfortable with the idea that this is a bit fake and I am putting on a show and everyone's at peace with it, I think you'll find the team will follow. Sam, it's been a big couple of months with trials. We've had that rather... well, landmark trial about weights in emergency department. We've also had what I would describe as quite a interesting trial to do with pre-hospital fluids. The refill trial, much anticipated. You were involved with the publication in that you did a editorial when this was published on Critical Care Reviews. And there's been toing and froing. This trial itself, I'll let you explain more. But to my mind, they looked at whether there was a difference between using blood or blood products pre-hospital and using non-blood products, so crystalloid types, and came up with the answer there was no difference. And there's been lots of chat about this.
The dogma at the moment is that saline kills people because it's salty pasta water and it's the fluid of the devil. And basically anybody giving saline to a trauma patient is a fool. And that has been the dogma. And blood is amazing, isn't it? Fantastic. It's obviously the right thing to do. The patient has bled, so give them blood. The problem with that is that the blood that we give, mostly in this country at least, isn't blood. It's packed red cells. And packed red cells are really toxic stuff. You know, pH is 6.7, and the potassium in a bag of packed red cells is about 20. And you think about how quickly you put it in your bleeding trauma patient. If you did that with a bag of saline with potassium in, you know, people would be thinking you're trying to kill the patient. It makes your patient hypercalcemic, and we know that hypercalcemia is associated with increased mortality. So it's not quite as simple a question as salty water bad, blood good, because blood's also potentially bad. Also, it doesn't carry oxygen because it hasn't got any 2-3 DPG, da-da-da-da-da-da. Lots of things going on with that. But the point is, it's a reasonable question to ask. So what they did in this trial is a UK-based air ambulance trial where they went out, and if they had a patient who they thought was bleeding, pretty sick bleeding, you know, sort of systolic of 70, they'd randomize them to either saline boluses, as required, as indicated by the clinicians on scene, or they give them a combination of blood and lyoplasm, which is a sort of freeze-dried plasma substitute. And they followed the patients through to either mortality but also a combined endpoint of mortality with evidence of lactate clearance. That's been quite controversial because, you know, what's lactate clearance got to do with survival? Just did it around mortality. They'd have needed a trial, which would have been just too big to do. So they put in this combined thing and said, well, you know, if you can't even get lactate clearance moving, then you're probably not going to save lives anyway. So randomized controlled trial, you get one or the other, follow them through, see what happens. And the big headline figure was, made no difference. And the mortality and lactate clearance combined, no difference. If you just looked at mortality, no difference. If you just looked at lactate clearance, no difference. It just didn't seem to have an impact. There's some other really interesting stuff in here. What really got my attention was in the supplementary data, because I'm so nerdy, I read the supplementary data of papers. That's how bad I've got it. They looked at the hemoglobin concentration on arrival in ED. There was a small difference between the two groups, but in fact, the hemoglobin concentration was pretty much the same. You're not really getting much in the way of increased oxygen carrying capacity. It's almost as if you're giving one fluid is a colloid and one fluid is a crystalloid, really. What does all this mean? Should we give up blood and go back to saline? Probably not. There's really good pathophysiological evidence that if you've got an actively bleeding patient, then giving them plasma is not a good plan. The big controversy, how many of the patients in this trial were actively bleeding, who did need this sort of very advanced approach to blood replacement, or were they patients who'd bled a bit, dropped the blood pressure a bit, and then stopped bleeding, in which case, give them saline, give them blood, it's not going to make any difference. It's whether or not there were enough patients in this trial who truly could have benefited from the intervention. That's the big Twitter chat at the moment.
Lots and lots of talk in the blogosphere, and this is one of those that gets people like us excited and lots of people talking. I was listening to Karim Brohi talk to Scott Weingart on the MCRIT podcast just the other day. Still, I will have to recommend Scott's podcast. I know he's gone to a subscription model, but sometimes you have to pay for quality. So if you can, then do subscribe to MCRIT. And Karim was saying he'd been thinking long and hard about where these results came from, because it's such a in contrast to what he knows as an expert trauma surgeon who's thought about this over and over to an extent that, well, normal human beings haven't. And he had some really interesting thoughts about what it's to do with, whether it's to do with the patient group and the fact that some trauma centers are now getting patients to them who are surviving, who previously wouldn't have survived because our pre-hospital care is more advanced, but yet those trauma centers haven't quite kept up with the advances in pre-hospital care. Lots of things to think about. I think for me, physiologically, it makes sense that we give blood. We've set up to give blood. It's what we do in hospital. So it makes sense to me. And I think my idea would be, if you've got it, do it. And if you've not yet set up a system, perhaps work on other things first, would be my idea, because there's so many things we can make better in pre-hospital care. If it's there, use it. But don't commit a huge amount of time setting up a system if blood isn't yet with your service.
Yeah, and blood didn't make it worse. It wasn't as if that saline was better. Carry on giving you blood seems a reasonable thing to do.
So much to think about. So already in these posts that we've had this month, we've had a couple of other blog posts, slightly different topics. It was really nice to hear from Natalie talking about breastfeeding in the emergency department. Simon, this is not something that you and I can necessarily say we have personal experience of, and our children are older now. So it is useful very much for us to be reminded of just how these things can affect some of our patients who are coming to us, and how we can help and be sympathetic. Because although every time I say to some, well, I've stopped saying, I know how you feel. Do you ever say that to patients anymore? I know how you feel. Because I've just started saying is, I can't possibly understand how you feel. And this is one of those circumstances. This is a helpful aid memoir and thought-provoking post for us to just consider something that, especially for people like myself and Simon, may not come into our mind that often.
Yeah, it's a really good post, actually. And this, I'd learned quite a lot of things in there, which I had absolutely no idea about before, including galactagogues, which is not a Doctor Who character, but is a drug which can induce lactation. There's some proper physiology, proper learning in here. So I definitely have a read.
It's amazing, isn't it? We're very lucky doing a specialty which covers so many things. You can never say you've learned it all, can you? And this was another, next post was another one not dissimilar to that, talking about genetic testing and how perhaps in some years, this may become something else that we have to think about in the emergency department to help tailor our treatment.
John McDermott did his training with us. He was a, I think, foundation doctor and then maybe a junior doctor as a physician working with us here in Manchester. He's an absolutely brilliant guy. He's got a brain the size of a planet. And he's done his PhD in research looking at near patient testing for genetics. Yep, you heard me right. So this is a machine that sits by the patient and you can actually do genetic tests on the patient to find out whether they've got particular gene differences, which may then have an impact on their health, or in this case, in particular, around pharmacology. This study is not an emergency medicine study, but we've put it in here because we genuinely believe that there is a future here, that when people like us are doing podcasts in 20, 30 years' time, they'll be talking about this being a regular thing in the emergency department. You all know that aminoglycosides can cause deafness, and in particular problem in neonates because they're particularly susceptible to it. And obviously, if you give the wrong drug to the wrong patient, they become deaf. That's obviously a disaster for them. So what they're able to do with a bedside test here is test the neonates themselves and find out whether they've got the genetic mutation which makes them susceptible to aminoglycosides. And then if they have, don't give them the drugs. It's that simple, but also that brilliant. And it's this whole idea that from when I was at university learning the initial things about genetics and being told that this was the future, and spending the rest of my career largely being disappointed in acute care, that it's not made that much of a difference. Potentially, we're on a threshold of some really interesting stuff. So please go and have a read of that. I think it's really fascinating. It's great work from John, and I'm sure we're going to hear more from him in the future.
There is much more to emergency medicine in the future than perhaps what we see now, and lots to keep you excited and interested. Finally, Simon, actually back to the beginning of March, way back, Dan Horner did a post about the 4D study. This is to do with DVTs. Of course, regular listeners to the blog will know that Dan is a particular expert in hematological type medicine, particularly thrombosis. And this was to evaluate the safety and efficacy of a diagnostic algorithm for DVT using a clinical pretest probability. We love pretest probabilities, don't we?
We do.
We can't get enough of them. So how did you feel about this paper, Simon?
Really interesting. So the 4D study, again, yes, you're right, Dan Horner did the review. And actually, the paper itself is out from Canada. The second author there, Kirsten DeWitt, also trained with us here in Manchester. She did her PhD with us in Manchester. So it's a bit of a Manchester fest today. It's all good. It's lovely to see people who've been trainees through with us go on to amazing things. So Kirsten's now out in Canada doing amazing research. The thing with this study is, do you feel like you do D-dimers in patients and then you have to send loads of them to do ultrasounds because the D-dimer has come back slightly high? Yes, you do, because that's the experience of pretty much everybody. So what they did in this study is they changed the way that they looked at things. So if you were a low clinical pretest probability, they accepted a higher level of D-dimer to allow you to still rule out. So if you're low probability, they go up to 1,000 nanograms per mil. And if it's below that, say no, negative, off you go. And if it's a moderate test probability, they go for 500. Whereas in most of the UK, we're operating at 500 for everybody. And then they looked essentially in 1,500 odd patients, whether that made a difference, and it didn't. It's a perfectly safe approach. You're not going to miss any more DVTs. And this kind of fits, doesn't it? So we've seen work along these lines before, looking at age-related D-dimers, and we can adjust the level of that. This is another way of doing that, perhaps in a younger age group where the age adjustment is not a possible, and it will reduce the number of ultrasounds you need to do. You don't have to see the patient so often. You can reassure them earlier. You don't have to scare them half to death. That's a real step forward. But this is a derivation study. Therefore, it probably looks great. So what Dan has said in his review is this looks fantastic. You might want to adopt it in some cases, but probably we'd like to see a validation study before we adopt it widely. And I think that's good advice.
The more nuance we can get with our diagnostic decision making, the better. Medicine is not a binary world where there is a cutoff below which you're fine and above which it's bad. And the more we can do this, and it's going to come with D-dimers, I think it'll probably come with high sensitivity troponin as well, whereby it's not just one number fits all. And it does depend, away from perhaps what we feel at the moment, on often a clinician's ability to do a clinical assessment. So that idea that we're all losing our skills because we're becoming dependent on tests, I think we're going to end up going the other way, because all of the tests you do are dependent on the clinical assessment you've done. And that clinical assessment has to be of a high quality. So this for me is nice because it's bringing back those skills that we all have. I have to say, I've seen wane a little bit if we become more and more dependent on tests and scans and all of that. So I like this. I love Bayesian type analysis. This is a good thing for me.
I agree. And it also fits in with all the work Dan's put together around VTE work. And if you want to spend a good day going through all his posts, you will know so much more about thromboembolism. He's a bit of a genius in this area.
Well, Simon, there we go. That's 2 months and a conference discussed in under half an hour. not bad. We will commit, I think, to being back to a monthly podcast by next month. We don't have the excuse of a conference or a festive holiday to, although perhaps, Simon, you do.
Yeah, I'm off to Lithuania, which I'm really looking forward to. It's a new specialty emergency medicine in Lithuania. There's some fantastically enthusiastic young emergency physicians out there. I'm really looking forward to seeing them.
Well, you take care out there. It's an interesting part of the world. So be safe. And as the St. Emlyn podcast, as we've always said, keep enjoying emergency medicine. And if you're not enjoying it, find somebody to chat to. Please don't throw in the towel. There's so much to look forward to, so many things to be optimistic about. And in the end, in what other specialty can you make such a big difference to people's lives on a day-to-day basis? Take care, everyone.